Webtext Core Text. Resituating and Remediating the Canons, a Cultural Historical Remapping of Rhetorical Activity. An earlier version of this argument was presented February 6, 2005 by Paul Pryor in a plenary talk at the Santa Barbara Conference, Writing Research in the Making. Contributors: Paul Pryor, Janine Solberg, Patrick Berry, Hannah Belwar, Bill Tuning, Karen Lunsford, Liz Rowan, Kevin Rusin, Mary Sheridan Rabidow, Jody Shipka, Derek Van Ittersom, and Joyce Walker. Some opening comments for the audio. History and Kairos matter. The original audio version of the core text was recorded in October in Champaign, Illinois. We wanted to gesture toward two texts that might bookend some of our arguments. One was the Phaedrus, where Plato articulates a notion of rhetoric as psychogogia, forming souls, where Socrates and Phaedrus engage in dialogue in a grove of trees beside a stream to the music of cicadas, a dialogue where that place was drawn into the discourse. The second text was Edward Hutchins' Cognition in the Wild, where he argues for studying people in everyday contexts and closely attending to how everyday tools and environments shape their thinking and action. Thus, I recorded that first audio in a local prairie, near a stream and trees, where insects and birds could be heard. However, we revised the core text, and it's now late January in Champaign. It's a frigid day out, and few birds can be heard. I had planned to record at home with the sounds of my daughter's cello and bass playing in the background, but 2 days ago she caught a virus. She's downstairs with the temperature over 100, watching Looney Tunes and drinking lots of fluids. This reading of the core text is being recorded in the wild, not in a studio. You may hear some background noises, but the clearest sign of nature today may be the heat kicking on, or me coughing. In any case, other than setting and these opening comments, the goal here is to present the same text as in the PDF and HTML versions. I will not read most punctuation or capitalization, of course. I won't read all the dates of sources. I may say a bit extra in some places to convey vital visual information, and I imagine I may misread or falter at some points. But otherwise, this audio is as close to the PDF and HTML versions as is possible. Introduction. The five classical canons that we've listed below, with first their Latin and then their Greek names in parentheses, have offered a map for rhetors and a frame for rhetoricians for at least two millennia. Invention, inventio, heuresis, arrangement, dispositio, taxis, style, elocutio, lexis, memory, memoria, neme, delivery, actio, pronunciatio, hypocrisis. The first three, invention, arrangement, style, emerged earliest and have remained the most robust in the last several centuries. Whereas other maps that ancient rhetoricians bequeathed us, for example, forensic, deliberative, and epideictic discourse, ethos, pathos, and logos, the topics, tropes, identify types of discourse, the canons are unique in that they aim to map rhetorical activity. It is probably that emphasis on activity that has associated the canon so closely with both rhetorical practice and pedagogy. In this web text, we argue that it's time to look to a new mapping of rhetorical activity, one that acknowledges advances in our understanding of language, semiotics, human development, technology, and society. We should start with two clarifications. First, this argument primarily addresses the canons of rhetoric from our perspective as writing studies researchers, rather than from the perspective of classicists. As writing researchers, we approach classical rhetoric much as Roland Barthes suggested, as a matter of history. It is in part to address the freight of this history, woven often tacitly into our languages, institutions, and practices, that we take up the canons of rhetoric and propose resituating and remediating them. Second, as we examine the map the rhetorical canons have offered and propose a new mapping, we must acknowledge that we do not believe that this new mapping has only recently become necessary. The digitization of semiosis has certainly made the limits of the canons more palpable, but we would argue that the problems were there from the start. In other words, without in any way discounting the insightful intellectual labor of rhetoric's classical pioneers, or the value of studying the products of that labor to enrich our understanding and practice today, we suggest that the canons offered only a partial map, even of the rhetorical and political worlds of ancient Greece. Delivery problems. As many scholars have noted, see for example Sharon Crawley, current traditional rhetoric effectively shrank the canons to arrangement and style. As writing studies emerged in the 1970s as a distinct site of disciplinary activity, attention to invention merged powerfully with attention to cognitive process in the formation of the process movement, a movement that linked theory, research, pedagogy, and practice. In the last decade or so, another of the classical canons, delivery, has been reanimated as the field's attention has turned to electronic and digital media. In light of this renewed attention, we take up delivery as a strategic example to illustrate the kinds of fundamental problems we and others have found with the classical canons. Through an analysis of delivery, we aim to identify the broader problems deeply embedded in the texture of the classical map, and we argue for remapping rhetorical activity, for resituating and remediating the canons, rather than continuing to pour ever more and ever more alien content into those ancient vessels. Under the prototype of oratory, delivery was about gesture, stance, gaze, dress, voice quality, intonation, and so on. As writing seemed to overtake talk as the dominant mode of civic legal life, delivery fell into neglect, along with memory, understood to be about recall for lines of argument in oral debate, and/or about memorization of set speeches. Observers as diverse as Bart and George Kennedy could agree that the last two canons became peripheral in a literate age. What use are gestures, dress, stance, vocalization, and memorization to a text? Consider in contrast Lev Vygotsky, who saw externally mediated memory systems like those of writing as a matter of the revolutionary reorganization of memory, as a key step in human history. This fading of delivery and memory tells us much about how firmly rhetoric has been anchored in a narrow range of contexts for specific social-cultural conditions and with a prototypical mode. Rhetoric was tailored to the public life of Greece, then Rome, then the Church. Speech was the prototypical mode, but rhetoric has certainly adapted to new modes. Orality was partly eclipsed by literacy, a process obvious with the medieval Ars Dicta Minis, the manuals of letter writing, and both now feel the pressure of the digital age. However, rhetoric has only recently and partially begun to theorize mode. It's instructive to attend to recent attempts to rehabilitate delivery. When Robert Connor sought to revive delivery, for example, he did so in another local institutional context and mode, exploring the delivery aspects of the student research paper, the type of paper, the typography, margins, printer options, and so on. Kathleen Welch has been arguing for two decades that we should reconceive delivery as medium, understood especially through the theories of Walter Ong and Marshall McLuhan. In Electric Rhetoric, Welch notes varied media, but Ong's electricity leads her to focus primarily on retrofixing rhetoric to address television, with delivery becoming an important televisual domain. Add panning cameras, newsroom furnishings, corporations, and postmodern huts, houses using televisions, to the old issues of delivery. In short, when delivery becomes unfixed from one set of institutional contexts, one mode, it is typically refixed in another institutional context and mode. It's important to recognize that rhetoric was already multimodal for the ancient Greeks. They didn't need the printing press or the web. Early in Plato's famous Phaedrus, Phaedrus reads Lysias' speech on love to Socrates, who has guessed Phaedrus would have the written text hidden in his cloak, and would have been poring over it for his studies. In fact, Socrates insists that Phaedrus read the speech on love so he can get a precise representation of it. He tells Phaedrus he has no interest in Phaedrus practicing his oratory on him when, quote, Lysias himself is here present, close quote. For Plato, then, and this in spite of his sharp criticism of writing later in the same dialogue, writing was not only a familiar, expected pedagogic practice, but also a valued means of storing precise, detailed representations of discourse. Remediating and redistributing delivery. Like Welch, we propose theorizing delivery, but we are offering a different name to start and a different mix of theoretical lenses. Delivery might be reconceived as mediation. By mediation, we're thinking of Jay Bolter and Richard Grusin's Remediations, close to McLuhan, but also of Vygotsky's cultural historical approach to mediated activity, and Bruno Latour's accounts of technical mediation, of detours, delegations, and hybrids. Latour, interestingly, begins with another Greek, Daedalus, the crafty engineer. What mediations, what kinds of detours might delivery of a text involve? Do we write a text to be read silently, read aloud as a speech, recorded on a DVD, or performed by various groups of actors on a stage? What typeface do we use? What color? Do we deliver the document on paper, on the screen, or in some other medium? If on paper, by mail or by hand? If by hand, do we do it ourselves, or do we have someone else do it? Do we synchronize the delivery with some other event? Or perhaps we deliver it, think espionage, think like Irving Goffman of the stratagems of con artists, by allowing others to find it in another place. Do we need to deliver the text first to an intermediary, for example, an editor, a publisher, a boss, for review, to get it out to a public of some size? Or do we want the text to be distributed in encrypted formats to a small, select distribution list? Or do we divide up the delivery of the message so that the chances of illicit use are limited? Think about systems to deliver the authorization codes for nuclear weapons. As these questions begin to suggest, delivery seems to encompass two related but distinct types of issues, mediation and distribution. In Jody Shipka's account of her activity-based multimodal approach to composition, we see how she invites her students to conceive of their work as engineering rhetorical events, and we glimpse the truly complex means of mediation and distribution the students devise to achieve specific rhetorical effects. Moreover, her work highlights the fact that mediation is not necessarily singular, a choice of this means or that. It may involve a distribution of means, a configuration, a dispersion. We may pursue rhetorical goals through a variety of genres in different media with different distributions across a series of events and texts. As an idealized map of rhetorical activity, the canons invite a sequential reading. The rhetor invents, arranges, crafts style, memorizes, and finally delivers. However, as in Burke's Pentad or Jakobson's Model of Communication, both of which offer simultaneous multifunctional accounts where all the elements are always co-present, though in varying degrees of prominence or relevance, current thinking about the canons and, indeed, key elements of historical practice reject that kind of linear reading. Invention, for example, is widely understood as a process that goes on throughout the entire work, not something done first, then funneled into an arrangement, then enacted in words, then stored in some memory, and then delivered. Mediation and distribution are also phenomena that operate at each moment in the process, as the text is always being mediated and distributed in some fashion, actually in multiple ways. In summary, the canon of delivery does not focus attention on the possible rhetorical configurations of distribution mode and other mediations. It does not alert us to take a broader view of the rhetorical landscape, to the possibility of rhetorical campaigns, nor does it feed back easily into a recognition of the arrays and chains of distribution, mode, and mediation in rhetorical processes. On the classical map, delivery is traced on a scene of individual production rather than on fields of cultural historical practice. Given these multiple limits, we argued that it makes more sense to begin remapping rhetorical activity to trace distribution and mediation than to attempt to retrofit this ancient tool to do varieties of work it was never designed to address. The rhetorical scene. Here we reach the core of the problem, the prototypical scene of rhetoric, a model grounded in a speaker and hearer, essentially in monologue, even if turn-taking creates a chain of monologues. Critics of classical rhetoric's modern redeployments are fairly united in their concern for the scope of this model. As Dilip Gangkar argues, quote, "Even a renovated Ciceronian-Aristotelian theory of rhetoric, so long as it remains committed to the view of the speaker-author as the origin of discourse, is severely handicapped in reading discursive formations of not only modern science, but also modern polity." Close quote. Science, of course, represents an extension of rhetoric, but polity is what rhetoric was designed for, should be where it has the home court advantage. Gangkar goes on to mention things like the congressional record, legislative tracts, commission reports, radio talk shows, and television. Media, in the corporate mass sense, are not a trivial detour from the old model. Kenneth Burke noted the way modern media alter the scene and effects of rhetoric. Quote, "A good rhetoric, neglected by the press, obviously cannot be so communicative as a poor rhetoric backed nationwide by headlines." Close quote. The continuing belief in 2006 among many U.S. citizens that Iraq had nuclear weapons and was directly involved in the 9/11-2001 attacks on the Twin Towers in New York offers us a clear illustration of Burke's point. Goffman's phenomenological critique of modern language and communication theories, for their allegiance to prototypical speaker-hearer dyads, offers an incisive analysis of and remedy to such scenes. When Goffman discusses footings, frames, and participation structures, he explodes every term and re-scenes the site of discourse. A speaker must be decomposed into author, principal, and animator, and Goffman was explicitly offering that three-part scheme as a generic first pass toward a diverse array of culturally situated footings. See also, for example, Judith Irvine's wonderful delineations of complex framings of participation. Listeners or viewers are likewise decomposed into addressed or unaddressed, ratified or unratified, with variable access to the speaker's communication. Goffman rejects that idealized pair of talking heads that has entranced so many linguists, pointing instead to concrete groupings of people, say, haggling in a crowded town market. He rejects the imposition of a shared, consensual, homogeneous space and reportrays interaction as wildly laminated and asymmetric. For Goffman, audiences are constantly active, co-producers of the configuration of footings and the discourse itself. Goffman's scenes of semiotic interaction challenge the abstract, dyadic, production-oriented bias that lies at the heart of the rhetorical canons. Take 1, revising the canons. Restaging the scene of rhetorical encounters calls for an expanded dialogical mapping of rhetorical activity. Writers, for example, routinely work to shape the reception of their texts. We might hand a draft to someone and suggest a motive for reading. "I thought you might want to read this before our meeting so you'd know how things are going in the program." Or a framing. "It's still a rough draft." Or a kind of desired response. "Please let me know if I've addressed your concerns." We might work more diffusely to build a positive climate for reception. Oddly, and one of the clearest signs of a dyadic, production-oriented perspective, audience is not one of the canons. Audience is addressed, considered through backdoors, such as an invention by way of the commonplaces, but real audiences receiving the text and doing something with it are not figured in. Taking into account the reception and the response of audiences would expand the canons. It would imagine rhetorical utterances as dialogic in Valentin Voloshinov and Mikhail Bakhtin's sense, a circuit only completed through the flow of contact. Folded back into the process, reception directs our attention to the many different receptions, chains that stretch from a writer's moment-to-moment reviewing of a text to perhaps the kind of in-progress oral, written, and material responses to a series of texts that are cycled through an organization. Where are we now? Perhaps we might revise the canons by elaborating the two senses of delivery and adding reception. So, revising the canons, take one, invention, arrangement, style, memory, mediation, distribution, reception. Society and socialization. Take one, however, still seems to leave much off the map. Gonkar and Burke were pointing not only to more complex participation structures, but also to complex institutional networks. Consider recent developments in the U.S. political system. How would the classical canons, or for that matter the topics, or ethos, pathos, and logos, help us to analyze the effects of, or plan a strategy comparable to that of the far right over the past few decades? David Brock, as a former insider, has detailed some of this long-term campaign. The formation of far-right think tanks, cultivation of journalists, intellectuals, and media personalities like Rush Limbaugh, changing Federal Communications Commission rules on media concentration and regulation, the campaign to centralize and politicize Protestant religious organizations, journalists secretly on the government payroll, strongly ideological judicial appointments across decades, and the IRS review of the nonprofit tax status of organizations like the NAACP and anti-war churches. Consider the following quote, found in a 2004 report of the Defense Science Board's Task Force on Strategic Communications, aka propaganda. Quote, "Information saturation means attention, not information, becomes a scarce resource. Power flows to credible messengers. Asymmetrical credibility matters. What's around information is critical. Reputations count. Brands are important. Editors, filters, and cue givers are influential." 50 years ago, political struggles were about the ability to control and transmit scarce information. Today, political struggles are about the creation and destruction of credibility. Close quote. Rhetoric could say ethos here, but note whose ethos is being highlighted. Editors? Filters? Cue givers? In fact, no part of classical rhetoric was oriented to sustained ideological struggle to control of the apparatus of the state and of cultural production. Are such struggles not a part of rhetorical activity? What if we redesign the canons, starting with the prototype of the full range of activities involved as a bill in the U.S. Congress becomes a law and then is enacted in practice? What we need here is something more like Latour's actor network theory, or Charles Bazerman's heterogeneous symbolic engineering. The rich account he offers of Edison suggests the kind of shape and complexity we should anticipate in considering rhetorical action. Latour's notion of black boxing is suggestive, as it highlights production of artifacts, material, and semiotic. Black boxing refers to the process of producing established facts or unproblematic elements, whose contentious, troubled histories become, for practical purposes, invisible. Latour notes the way a black box functions automatically and stiffly resists being, quote, disassociated, dismantled, renegotiate it, reappropriate it, close quote. To take one of Latour's favorite examples, the notion today, post-Pasteur, that microbes are a primary vector of diseases has become a given, a black box. We need do no rhetorical work to recruit this notion in a discussion of the potential dangers of bird flu. Likewise, the binary logic of integrated circuits has become so widely established materially and conceptually that it's difficult to imagine the forces that would be needed to undo this black-boxed piece of design history. In contrast, if we wish to argue that the United States should rapidly switch to a hydrogen-powered economy, immense material and rhetorical work would lie ahead of us. Serious attention to society implies serious attention as well to socialization, to the socio-historic production of people. As Barthes points out, Plato defined true rhetoric as a psychagogia, the leading or formation of people's souls through discourse, public and private. Plato argues that rhetoric must begin by knowing what types of souls there are and what types of arguments will lead them. Its goal is to instill in them knowledge, order, and justice so that they can escape the birth-rebirth cycle on this lowly plane of existence. Not perhaps a key goal for many of us today. For Plato, the soul was a field in which true rhetors must sow their seeds. This formulation resonates to a point with cultural historical activity theory's attention to making people. However, Marx offered another way to understand types of people, seeing them as made in historical conditions, as shaped, though not determined, by social relations of production. Immersed in both traditions, rhetorical and Marxist, Burke began to articulate why it was critical to see making people as part of rhetoric. Consider the following quotes from A Rhetoric of Motives. Quote, "Such considerations make us alert to the ingredient of rhetoric in all socialization, considered as a moralizing process. Only those voices from without are effective which can speak in the language of a voice within." Close quote. A second quote. "Often we must think of rhetoric not in terms of some one particular address, but as a general body of identifications that owe their convincingness much more to trivial repetition and dull reinforcement than to exceptional rhetorical skill." Close quote. The first quote resonates with Bakhtin's account of ideological becoming as the interplay between authoritative and internally persuasive discourses. The second quote seems to resonate with Bourdieu's notion of habitus. Because Burke defines the basic function of rhetoric as, quote, "the use of words by human agents to form attitudes or to induce actions in other human agents," close quote, education, socialization, or indoctrination all become basic rhetorical acts. The focal persuasive message begins to recede against a background of explicit campaigns of persuasion and more tacit socializing pressures of everyday cultural practice. If persuasive identification has been prefabricated through socialization and through populating the world with black-boxed artifacts, then little or no focal persuasion need be done now. This kind of counter-rhetoric can be found in Karen Lunsford's notion of distributed argumentative activity, which highlights ways that multiple mediations, socialization, production of artifacts including texts, and establishment of institutions combine in argumentative activity. Burke begins to gesture toward a rhetoric that encompasses socialization, but we think we can find richer toolkits than those he offered. Voloshinov and Vygotsky in the 1920s began traditions grounded in a Marxist framework for considering semiotic mediation of thought, action, and personality as concrete cultural historical practice. Take 2, a cultural historical remapping of rhetorical activity. The canons of classical rhetoric, then, offer us a snapshot, a synchronic rhetoric, too situated in particular homogeneous worlds, and not situated enough in emergent laminated histories. Too centered on the producer rather than the system. Too focused on language at the expense of a full semiotics. We turn here to cultural historical activity theory, CHAT. See, for example, Michael Kohl, Eero Engström, Sylvia Scribner, James Wirsch, Pablo Del Rio, and Amelia Alvarez, to provide a richer framework for conceptualizing rhetorical activity. By CHAT, we mean the emergent synthesis that has brought together Vygotskian psychology, Voloshinovian and Bakhtinian semiotics, Latour's actor network theory, and situated phenomenological work in sociology and anthropology. CHAT argues that activity is situated in concrete interactions that are simultaneously improvised locally and mediated by historically provided tools and practices. These tools and practices range from machines, made objects, semiotic means, for example, languages, genres, iconographies, and institutions to structured environments, domesticated animals and plants, and indeed, people themselves. Mediated activity means that action and cognition are distributed over time and space, and among people, artifacts, and environments, and thus also laminated, as multiple frames or fields coexist in any situated act. In activity, people are socialized, brought into alignment with others, as they appropriate cultural resources. But they're also individuated, as their particular appropriations historically accumulate to form a particular individual. Through appropriation and individuation, socialization also opens up a space for cultural change, for a personalization of the social. Cultural historical activity theory points to a concrete historical rhetoric. Where Aristotle asks what the commonplaces of the people are, a cultural historical approach asks how people, institutions, and artifacts are made in history. This cultural historical approach suggests that, rather than revising and reinterpreting the classical canons, it is time to begin remapping the territory of rhetorical activity. So here's a map. Remapping rhetorical activity, take two. First column, literate activity, consisting of production, representation, distribution, reception, socialization, activity, and ecology. Literate activity happens in functional systems, composed of people, artifacts, practices, institutions, communities, and ecologies, which are located in laminated chronotopes, embodied, represented, embedded. In the broadest context, this remapping begins with laminated chronotopes, the time spaces Bakhtin first described. Chronotopes can be understood as embodied activity in the world, representational worlds, and chronotopes embedded in material and semiotic artifacts. Within these interpenetrated chronotopes, we then identify functional systems. See Hutchins. Functional systems, typified and fleeting, tie together people, artifacts, practices, institutions, communities, and ecologies around some array of current objectives, conscious and not. See Pryor and Pryor and Shipka for fuller accounts of laminated chronotopes and functional systems. The critical point here is that once socialization, Burke's body of identifications, has entered into the space of rhetorical activity, then the full range of material social ecologies have to be on the table as well. We would suggest Latour's Science in Action and Bazerman's The Languages of Edison's Light as foundational texts for these new cultural historical rhetorical canons. Finally, within functional systems, we then turn to a map of literate activity. We have placed this part of the map on the left and highest because it is closest in scale to the classical canons and closest to how we see our remapping being used for rhetorical practice and rhetorical instruction. Mapping literate activity. The terms of the map of literate activity, production, representation, distribution, reception, socialization, activity, and ecology, are not intended to evoke a series of steps, but to signal a multidimensional model, like Jakobson's model of language functions. Production directs our attention to the tools, practices, and contexts that shape the formation of a text or series of texts, as well as to the series of texts and artifacts produced. It merges individual and collective invention with the mediated force of technologies, genres, discourses, and practices. Representation involves the way a discourse is contextualized in talk, text, and mind. Representation highlights semiotic codes, discourses, and genres as representational artifacts. We're thinking here of Hutchins' notion of distributed cognition as the, quote, propagation of representational states across media, close quote, with media including the human mind and body. Representation collapses style and arrangement, but also expands them to encompass the full range of semiotic media and means found in representational artifacts of all kinds, material, machinic, biologic. Distribution involves the way particular media, technologies, and social practices disseminate a text and what a particular network signifies. It's important to stress that even a person sitting alone writing on a piece of paper that is read only by herself is displaying a type of distribution. Reception is actual reading, viewing, hearing, and response. How meaning is made, under what conditions, and for what ends. It is a mental and social activity. Reception can be, and often is, actively shaped by writers or distributors. Socialization is the making of people and the making of society in concrete history. As individuals engage in cultural practices, they are involved in apprenticeship, learning, and development. As situated engagement in cultural practices unfolds, society is reproduced, that is, transmitted and transformed in activity. Activity points to the more or less durable, goal-oriented, motivated projects that lead people to cooperation, indifference, and conflict. Cultural historical activity theories appear to offer richer ways to investigate and define these rhetorical situations. Ecology points to the biotic and natural world, which enables and constrains all the previous functions, and which may also be a domain of rhetorical action. Bazerman noted the ways scientists must deal with the responses not only of other scientists and publics, but also of the material world. And Monsanto certainly recognizes that the debate over genetically modified plants will be settled when all plants have genetically modified DNA, a condition we're fast approaching in the case of corn and soybeans. You may have noticed that mediation is not on this list. What happened to it? In fact, we did not drop it. From a cultural historical perspective, and adopting Wirsch's terms, we take mediated activity and mediated agency as fundamental units of analysis. In those terms, everything in the three maps of literate activity, functional systems, and chronotopes is about mediation. Using chat to form new canons. We intend this cultural historical remapping of rhetorical activity, this scheme of literate activity in functional systems in laminated chronotopes, to replace the classical five canons as a map for rhetorical action. Why do we argue for this remapping? First, we believe that chat offers a richer map of activity. Where the classical canons mapped the situational productive acts of a rudder, this chat map points to a complex set of interlocking systems within which rudders are formed, act, and navigate. Socialization, for example, is not represented as part of rhetorical activity by the classical canons. Rhetors drew on the commonplaces of the people, but the option of forming people and their commonplaces was off the map. If some readers might argue that classical rhetoricians were very attuned to learning, that their whole practice was predicated on the value of instruction, we wouldn't disagree. As we noted at the beginning, our argument is that the classical canons did not offer a full mapping of the actual rhetorical activity of the ancients. A cultural historical remapping of rhetorical activity should bring into sharper relief dimensions of ancient practices as well as of ours today. For researchers interested in analyzing rhetorical practice, this cultural historical remapping retunes attention. As in Lave and Wenger's cultural historical account of situated learning, this chat perspective integrates communication, learning, and social formation, seeing them not as separate categories, but as simultaneous, constant dimensions of any moment of life. This perspective tunes our attention to multimodality, not as a question of which mode a message might be placed in, but as a question of how multiple modes operate together in a single rhetorical act, and of how extended chains of modal transformations may be linked in a rhetorical trajectory. This map, in short, argues for attending to the full range of multimodality and to material ecologies throughout the process. It's not about the web or television, and it's not electricity. It's about attending to semiosis in whatever materials at whatever point in the activity. Finally, this account is fundamentally rhizomatic asking us to trace spatially and historically extended networks. These networks do not live in the boxes our cultures have defined for us, so researchers should not study and act inside of such boxes. Neither life nor rhetoric is composed of an archipelago of focal events, so researchers should be alert to extended semiotic campaigns, to interdiscursive connections across time, place, and social milieu. In terms of rhetorical action and instruction, this cultural historical remapping articulates an expanded space of rhetorical moves and contexts. In particular, whereas the history of rhetoric is focused on how rhetors take stock of the means of persuasion available in a rhetorical situation to craft and contextualize a message, a cultural historical mapping opens up consideration of how rhetors and audiences are socialized, how means are made and black-boxed, and how situations are built and altered. Attending to the socialization of people, to black-boxing, and to the profusion of semiotic objects seems like a purloined letter lying in our midst. We mention the far right, but also think of Disney, which is populating our world with t-shirts, stuffed animals, pajamas, coffee cups, TV shows, films, DVDs and CDs, mall stores, theme parks, books, and so on. When Disney wants to promote the next Britney Spears or the next Lion King, they don't have to make an isolated argument for a single product. They are working in a world populated with Disney artifacts that naturalize Disney, that incline people to attend favorably to whatever Disney offers next. As Umberto Eco argues, primary indexicality, that is, getting people's attention, is a significant act itself and forms the semiotic ground for any further communication. In short, we argue that a new set of canons is needed to resituate rhetoric in complex socio-historic worlds and to realize not simply a consistent multimodality, but a deep orientation to mediated activity and agency. Resituating and remediating the canons takes us beyond any single setting and mode and offers a new map for an expansive attention to the rhetorical dimensions of all activity. Resituating the canons in this fashion is not a panacea for writing studies or rhetoric. We believe, however, that these revised canons are an artifact that will afford useful reworkings and expansions of the realm of rhetoric. From the cortex to the data nodes. The individual data nodes that we have arrayed around our cortex are not intended to rehearse our analysis of the limits of the classical canons. Nor do they systematically unpack specific terms of the cultural historical remapping we have proposed. Instead, they represent a collage of images of literate and rhetorical activity that we have developed individually and jointly in our studies. Through these nodes, we present some of the spaces and paths that this new mapping makes more visible and navigable. In them, we enact the kind of attention to materiality and mediation that Anne Wysocki sees as the defining feature of new media texts. In content and form, the data nodes illustrate the value of a cultural historical remapping that can follow rhetorical activity wherever it goes and however it is conveyed. The data nodes focus on complex rhetorical remediations and trajectories. In a feminist web installation, Hannah Belwar, for example, explores the literate and multimodal character of healing or medicine as she remediates academic theory, a personal narrative of her own medical experiences and records, and a series of audio reflections on the relationship among academic, medical, and personal discourses. Patrick Berry traces how multiple modalities and contexts intersect, overlap, and echo one another around uptakes of Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion tale of the linguistic and social remediation of a London flower girl. Tracing a series of diversely mediated recontextualizations of the rhetorical, material, affective, and interpersonal strategies that a first-year composition student employed for an in-class activity called Music Day, Jody Shipka and Bill Tuning present five distinctly different but decidedly interrelated remediations of a composing process narrative that Shipka collected in a research interview. The data nodes also highlight socialization, the production of people in practice. Foregrounding the profoundly laminated nature of identity, Kevin Rusin, for example, examines dialogic relations among a college student's literate engagement as a mathematics major, a member of a sketch comedy troupe, and a developer of a new online role-playing game. Karen Lunsford examines how the digital remediation of copyright, peer review, and scientific transparency reshapes the experiences and stances of a scientist editor. Remediating a sampling of early 20th century career advice or training texts and films that were aimed at women office workers, Janine Solberg explores socialization as distributed work, mediated by texts and by the cultural and material channels through which those texts circulate. The data nodes pay close attention to the rhetorical affordances of materiality and mediation. Liz Rowan, for example, examines the ways a form of ordinary writing, venting, that is, writing graffiti on air vents, in the library stacks at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, can be understood as a system in which writers, readers, technologies, and ecologies act collectively and in a nonlinear fashion to produce meaning. In this case, to forge a collective memory of college life. Analyzing the situated practices of revision and redesign of a virtual art object, Paul Pryor presents mediational means, screens, programs, drawings, gestures, not simply as means of delivery, but as tools of production, forms of representation, key vectors of distribution, and sites of reception. Finally, the data nodes suggest that a cultural historical remapping resonates with the complex but everyday rhetorical challenges that people face. Mary Sheridan Rabidoff, for example, considers the rhetorical tasks that a new community arts organization, Artists Now, faces as it seeks to put up a billboard, tasks that go well beyond inventing text and image and delivering it onto a space, tasks that must navigate diverse material conditions, and the pivotal role of forces and context well removed from any moment of reading, writing, creating, and designing. Offering a close examination of writers engaged in memory work with digital tools, Derek Van Ittersom argues that while the rhetorical canon of memory continues to provide insight into memory work, such as the power of images and place memory, and into the generative aspects of memory, cultural historical activity theory is better able to account for permutations introduced by new artifacts, such as databases, new practices, such as those afforded by digital tools, and the interplay between functional systems and specific instances of literate activity. Joyce Walker narrates a story about a group of students who decided, for a multimodal class assignment, to give textual voice to trees on campus that were designated for removal. Walker argues that chat assists her in refashioning both practices of and rationales for a first-year composition course that emphasizes research, multimodal materialities, and an expansive awareness of rhetorical activity. These data nodes reflect our diverse interests, settings, subjects, practices, and materialities, but individually and jointly, through analyses and enactments, they have sharpened our awareness of the disjunctions between the rhetorical activities they trace and the spaces and tools offered by the classical canons. Working with these images of rhetorical activity has led us to argue through this cultural historical remapping of the canons.